Okay, why don't we get started? Welcome to our last CRECA lecture of the year. And before I introduce today's speaker, I want to just briefly thank the CRECA office staff who play a crucial role in coordinating our lecture series, in particular Laura Weigel, Drago Momcilic, and Julia Vasilenko, who have played different roles. They've sort of rotated through the events coordinator position and helped in the logistics in bringing our speakers to town and making sure they have places to sleep and food to eat and so forth. So today we're very privileged to have Holly Case, who is Associate Professor of History at Cornell University. And she earned her PhD at Stanford University in 2004. But she told me her proudest accomplishment is that she won the best chicken prize in her 4-H club. And she won the University of Michigan. Her teaching and research interests include modern Eastern Europe, the legacies of imperialism and the politics of violence. And her articles on Eastern European cultural identity and also the Holocaust have appeared in several edited volumes. Most importantly of all, her book-length study, The Transylvanian Question and the European Idea During World War II, was just published by Stanford University Press. So congratulations on that. And today her talk is called Right-Wing Federation Schemes in East Central Europe During World War II. So please welcome Holly Case.
Hi.
Hi.
It's really nice to be here. When I was instructed originally for lunch, I was supposed to go to the humanities building. And you know, when you think humanities building, you think squat, faux Victorian. And so when I saw the humanities building, I thought I should be hearing Carmina Burana in the background. And it just goes on and on. And I think humanities buildings should look like that, and that's why I definitely like Wisconsin. I want to thank Francine Hirsch for inviting me. I've been a great fan of her work for a long time, and so it's a great pleasure and privilege for me to be here and to meet all of you and to have such a good turnout, considering this is the last end of the semester when it's very difficult to generate energy and excitement for anything. I want to share with you, by way of introduction, an anecdote from my personal history. It's got nothing to do with the chicken, but all credit for that particular prize, with all fairness, should go to the chicken, now deceased. I was just a vehicle, really, for that event. But I was at the Wilson Center last year for a while, and one of the things that they ask fellows at the Wilson Center to do is give 5-minute presentations on their research. And so this is kind of like the final round of Jeopardy. And one of the persons presenting was a man by the name of Klaus Schwabe. He was a German. And he was writing on the origins of European unification projects. And he said, so he was writing on this history, and I asked the question, you know, after his 5 minutes were up, why write about the origins of European unification projects right now? Is there something about now that makes this a good time to write it? I mean, why not in the 70s? Why not, you know, in the 80s? Why not even in the 90s? Why now? And he said, his answer was very interesting. He said, well, the European Union has a lot of new members who don't really understand what European unification is about. And I feel it's important to produce a work that will have the capacity to instruct them in the nature of European unification projects and schemes so that they get it and so that they get the right message about what European unification is all about. And so afterwards we talked about, you know, what the right message would be, and he talked about the liberal ideas behind European unification and how it's about tolerance and getting over all of the problems that we had during World War I and then again during World War II and then having French-German rapprochement and all of these nice things that come about after World War II. And it struck me that first of all, you know, being an East Europeanist, I always feel a bit slapped around when somebody says, well, they need to be taught what European unification is all about, that kind of thing. And so I thought it would be interesting to see whether East Europeans had been thinking about federation projects prior to the European Union. And it turns out they were thinking about them quite a lot. I was surprised myself at the extent to which they were. And in looking into the history of European federation, and some people have looked at this as well, I discovered that in Germany in particular, European federation also had a very strong right-wing component. Namely, during the Second World War, Hitler conceptualized something called the Neue Europäische Ordnung, the New European Order, which was supposed to be a kind of federation under German dominance. But the language of the new European order was one of peace and division of labor, and it was very vague language. I'll talk about that in a second. But it also struck me as I started digging about in various archives that in East Central Europe there were a lot of plans for European unification, regional unification of various sorts on the part of liberals and left-wingers, as one would expect. But there were also several plans from the right. And one of the things that struck me is that it's important to understand these right-wing drives for European unification, not only from the perspective of Western Europe. I think Western Europeans should be aware that European unification is not einwandfrei, it's not completely clean, and that it's not a coincidence that a lot of right-wingers find themselves perfectly comfortable in the European Union, for example. Nor is it the case that right-wingers in East Central Europe feel categorically uncomfortable with European unification. Most of them think it's okay. And one of the things that I seek to explain with this particular project, which is a new project, is why is it that the right wing is okay with European unification? What does it see in European unification for itself, these extreme nationalists? What's in it for them? So I'm going to go back a little bit, and I'm going to do a kind of European unification in broad sweeping strokes, and I'm going to skip a lot. But I think it's important to understand some of the precedents for ideas about European unity, and I'm going to focus particularly on a couple of them. One is the so-called Young Europe, conceptualized by a man whose name was Giuseppe Mazzini. And Young Europe regarded the question of nationality, in the words of Mazzini himself, as it ought to be regarded, not as a mere tribute to local pride or local rights, but as a question of European division of labor. So this is early federation thinking. It's not really about everyone melding into a big federation. It's about this nation does this well, this nation does that well, and so we should divide up tasks so that we become more productive as a continent. And as you can see, built into this understanding is not an idea that we're all going to homogenize, but rather that we are going to specifically emphasize national attributes. So this is the beginning of the first half of the 19th century. And he talked about, quote, the association of free and equal peoples, very much a confederative idea. And a number of German, French, Italian, and Polish exiles of the Napoleonic Wars, and later individuals who were interested in national unification movements, hopped on board, theoretically at least, practically not much was happening at this time, with Mazzini's New Europe. So fast forward 100 years, this is how you know I'm skipping a lot, to the post-war period. So a lot of Mazzini's ideas after the Napoleonic Wars were in some respects a byproduct, a fallout of the conflicts brought about by the French Revolution and followed by the Napoleonic Wars. And Kuttenhof-Kalergi, this man, Richard Kuttenhof-Kalergi, who a fascinating guy, half Austrian, half Japanese, who conceptualized the idea of pan-Europe after World War I. Again, not a coincidence that it's after a major conflict. A lot of people at the time, Oswald Spengler, Paul Valéry, were thinking, well, World War I, not such a good idea. We all fought amongst ourselves. That was pretty Civil War-like of us. We should move on. We should do something a little more productive with our time, and we should get along and transcend some of our earlier issues that we had with one another. And a lot of people were sort of doom and gloom in this period, Valéry among them. Spengler wasn't too upbeat either. But Richard Kuttenhof-Kalergi had an idea, and he put it to paper in 1923 in a book that he called Pan-Europe. He said, constant retrospection is the chief cause of Europe's reaction and disunion. To bring about a change in this state of affairs is the duty of Europe's youth. Upon them it devolves to build up a new Europe on the wreckage of the old, to establish European organization in place of European anarchy. Pan-Europe signifies self-help through the consolidation of Europe into an ad hoc politico-economic federation. And you can see from the map more or less how he imagined this federation would look. You'll no doubt notice it includes lots of Africa. The colonies were not yet gone. Africa was not to be an equal partner in this federative scheme. It was to be basically a resources cow for Europe proper. But it gets painted in the same color nonetheless. And so this federative scheme was meant to overcome the divisions post World War I. And Kudinov Kalergi had an idea for how this was all going to start. And his idea, being an Austrian, having grown up in part anyway in Austria-Hungary, thought that the heavy center, the core of this new federation, would be in East Central Europe. And he saw the seed of Pan-Europe in something that was already starting to emerge as a result of the Paris peace conferences and the alliance system set up under the auspices of the French after World War I. And so this was the Little Entente, so Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia, which had a kind of alliance system that formed. And Kudinov Kalergi saw in the Little Entente a kind of seed for the future Pan-Europe. And he also said that the greatest advantage would be enjoyed by the states of Eastern Europe out of this federation. And so they would be the first ones to jump on board enthusiastically. Now, let's look a little bit at what the Little Entente was all about. So, the Little Entente was these three states, the red ones on the map. As you can see, they kind of neatly surround a fourth state, which is Hungary. And that's not a coincidence. Hungary had been much bigger, both in its own mind and on the map, prior to World War I. It lost a lot of territory, and so a lot of the new states that emerged after World War I, Czechoslovakia, Romania was there, but it got a lot bigger, Yugoslavia was not there, got territory from what had been the Hungarian kingdom. And so the Little Entente for Romanians and Yugoslavs and Czechoslovaks was perceived not so much as the seed of a new pan-Europe, although sometimes they used that language as well, but as a way to prevent Hungary from stretching its borders back to their old size. So it was an anti-revisionist alliance that was meant to keep, a defensive alliance that was meant to keep Hungary in check. So the Czech foreign minister, Edvard Beneš, who was the kind of the granddaddy of the Little Entente in Czechoslovakia, said in 1924 that the Little Entente was formally directed against Magyar irredentism and nationalism. And he said that he hoped it would someday move beyond this. But he said, "We cannot renounce any of our rights and claims in regard to the Magyars, nor any of our democratic principles." And at the same time, Hungarian statesmen insisted that a just revision of the treaties to give, you know, at least a little bit back would be reasonable. And so there was a lot of tension between the Little Entente and interwar Hungary. And although Beneš said he looked forward to a time when, quote, the Little Entente would no longer be directed against Hungary, in fact, that day never came. And the relationship between the French-sponsored alliance, the Little Entente, and Hungary was a hot-button issue throughout the interwar period. I mean, hot-button if you were there at the time. and let me show you the extent to which it was hot. So you can see this is the way that Hungarians imagine themselves, this kind of brain-like green, light green thing in the middle of Europe. And this is what happened after the war. They no longer look like a brain, and they're surrounded by new states, and they're really much smaller, and so they were quite annoyed. And if you make a comparison between territorial losses of Germany after World War I and territorial losses of Hungary, it's really kind of no comparison. I think Germany is like, what is it, 12%? Of its territory, and Hungary is two-thirds. So it's really quite a lot that we're talking about here. And then this is the cover of a recent book on the Little Entente, which actually causes Hungary to disappear, which I thought was interesting. And here you can see a propaganda postcard from the Hungarians. This is immediately after World War I. You can see that they feel themselves really small and embattled. They've got one little soldier and then all of these nasty soldiers trying to take their territory. And here's a more graphic one, grab, grab, grab. And they're very much after Hungarian territory. And there's a very clear sense of being embattled in the politics of interwar Hungary. So keep that in mind, put it on the back burner. We'll come back to it in a second. But I want to switch now to the late 1930s, when there's a different kind of funny bond being formed between a couple of states in the region. And that funny bond is between Poland and Romania, which have very powerful right-wing movements in the late 1930s, and they start to really sympathize with each other and get ideas about what they could do with those sympathies. So in 1938, a right-wing government came to power in Romania, and the Polish extreme right got really excited about what some of the right-wingers in Romania were quote-unquote achieving. And so they gathered around this journal called Prostos Mostu, and they took Romania's right-wing nationalization policy as a model for their own movement. One of my grad students at Cornell, Aaron Law, has written about how Polish nationalist Stanisław Piasecki lamented Poland's status as a laggard in nationalizing its country. And they said, look, Romania is really much better at nationalization and getting rid of undesirables, and here they were talking about Jews mostly, than we are. It says in this journal, it says, again, we are late. At one time, we could have been, if one considers a solution to the Jewish question, the first in Europe to take upon themselves its resolution. We could have preceded Hitler. We could have all the more been first in Central Europe. Again, we will be at the tail end. This is a very different Poland than the one that we generally get presented with, the sort of first victim of Nazi Germany that has no sympathy with what the Germans are doing. And here you have quite deep sympathy. Admittedly, this is before 1939. So another Polish nationalist by the name of Karol Zbyszewski even proposed a union between right-wing Romania and right-wing Poland. And so in January of 1938, he wrote, Romania is friendly. And imagine a 50 million person country dividing Europe in half. And here he's thinking of Romania and Poland together. What a great idea, they said. And with the death of the extreme right-wing crazy man Corneliu Zelia Codreanu in Romania, the Polish right published in December of 1938 a front page hagiographic obituary declaring him the hope of Romania. And so there were some of these ideas out there in the air that right-wingers could get together as right-wingers to secure some of their right-wing goals. So let's talk about World War II, since we're up to that time period. Let's start with Germany, because Germany is kind of the one about which people know the most. So Hitler had, as I mentioned before, this new European order. And this term was as vague as you can possibly imagine, and it was meant to be. So in April of 1940, Goebbels told the German press, if anyone asks, how do you conceive of the new Europe, we have to reply that we don't know. Anybody can interpret it as they wish. So they were very careful to have this term out there that suggested that any nationalist aspirant in the new European order could imagine its state, into it however they liked. It's not a coincidence, for example, that he named SS divisions in such a way that people could imagine themselves as part of this new European order. If you think of the name of the French SS division, the Charlemagne division, it was very much harkening back to a day when France and Germany were united under Charlemagne. And then there were some SS divisions in the east. There was one in northern Serbia, which was called the Eugene of Savoy, which was meant to encourage its participants to harken back to the days when they were fighting the Turks. And then there was an SS division in Bosnia that was called the Hanjar division, and they wore fezes, and so they were meant to harken back to the days when they were fighting non-Turks. And so this new European order was designed very much to allow people to imagine themselves in it. And it was very flexible and it was extremely vague. And many of Hitler's allies did interpret the new European order just as they wished. They imagined their states renewed and expanded in a post-war nationalist utopia, one that didn't differ significantly from some of the quote-unquote liberal visions they had during the interwar period. And the Allied aspirations for a post-war order. So a Bulgarian specialist on international law, who wrote an extreme right-wing magazine during the war, wrote in 1941 that the idea of a so-called pan-Europe, and he's using Kudinov Galerki's language here, the idea of a so-called pan-Europe, that Europe should turn into a single federation, stressing the solidarity of European nations, is precisely what Germany is calling for today. So he didn't see any difference between Kudinov Galerki of 1923 and Hitler of 1941. Similarly, in a conversation with the Slovak ambassador to Romania in May of 1942, the Romanian diplomat Vasile Stoica commented that, quote, the difference between the Atlantic Charter and the position of Berlin on the post-war settlement is not great and is likely to grow even smaller as the war continues. So they didn't even see a difference between the war aims of the Allies and the war aims of Nazi Germany, which is pretty interesting. So Hitler's allies in East Central Europe, nevertheless, in 1942, when Hitler started to lose, and after Stalingrad in particular, started to get impatient for assurances that their vision for a new Europe would be taken into account when it came to the shakedown after the war. So by the autumn of 1942, leaders in the Axis camp had begun to lament the lack of clear content in the German vision for the Neue Europäische Ordnung. And so Ribbentrop, ever clever, ever not being listened to by the Führer, wrote a piece called European Federal State in 1943. And Article 1 says, in order to give tangible expression to the common destiny shared by the European peoples, so that wars will no more be waged between the European peoples, the undersigned states hereby establish for all time the European Federal State. So he wanted to put something on paper that would throw a bone to the Allies so that they would keep fighting, I mean, not those allies, the allies of Nazi Germany, so that they would keep fighting with Nazi Germany. And this was to include Germany, Italy, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, Finland, Estonia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, Croatia, and Spain. So pretty much your standard Europe. And this was meant to provide some conceptualization for the big plan, but it reached Hitler's desk and Hitler was not willing to make any concessions to a kind of concrete notion of what the new European order would be like, so it was tabled. Okay, meanwhile, there are several governments in exile, particularly from East Central Europe. Once the Nazis come in, some of the governments, particularly of Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, take off. They go to places like London, they hang out in New York, and they start coming up with some ideas for how they're going to order East Central Europe after World War II. And their big concern is, well, you've got Germany on one side, you've got the Soviet Union on the other, and look what happened in 1939 or 1938 in some cases. We were really flailing and the Allies didn't come to our aid. We can only rely on each other if we want to survive in this world. And so there were declarations by the governments in exile of Poland and Czechoslovakia in 1940 and Greece and Yugoslavia in 1942 that conceptualized alliances that were meant to be the seeds of federations. And people like the Polish statesman and diplomat Anatol Mühlstein and the Czechoslovak statesman Milan Hoxha wrote books and published ideas about a post-war federation that would prevent East Central Europe from falling into the grip of Nazi, of Germany in particular, but also of the Soviet Union. And so this was happening, governments in exile. These are sort of the liberals, remnant liberals of a sort. And nevertheless, many key statesmen who were right-wingers within East Central Europe were watching this stuff with interest. And so they even echoed some of the ideas or came up with their own for federation. So on March 16th of 1943, for example, the Romanian Foreign Minister Vasile Stoica asked the Slovak ambassador to Romania if he could borrow a copy of Milan Hoxha's 1942 book on Federation in Central Europe. And they both laughed because the Slovak ambassador said, "That's so funny, I was just about to ask you if I could borrow it from you." So they both were thinking of reading this book by Milan Hoxha that was about federative schemes. And these are some pretty hardcore right-wingers involved. So also the Slovak right-wing statesman Ferdinand Djurčanski, who had been foreign and interior minister during the wartime right-wing Slovak Republic under Jozef Tiso, wrote a quirky piece in 1944 in German called Central Europe Past and Future, in which he called for a variation on Czech and Hungarian federation ideas in the form of a confederation of equal independent states. He said, "This solution offers protections for the freedom and independence of the peoples living in Central Europe, makes possible an obligatory solution for whatever tensions arise between units within the Confederation, as well as protection against attacks on Central Europe from the outside." And so even this person who was in the Tiso regime, and this is a state, Slovakia, that just got its independence, and already he's saying, we need to be in a federation right now. Okay, let's return to, what the new European order color-wise would have looked like. This is Milan Hoxha and Peter II of Yugoslavia. And here's Djurčanski on the left, the Hitler lookalike. Let's return to the Little Entente. So the Little Entente, after the collapse of the interwar Paris peace system, so Hitler really does a number on that one, and a lot of the states get invaded or broken up or they lose territory. Czechoslovakia, as you know, just poof, gone. And then Yugoslavia gets invaded in 1941. Romania gets smaller. Hungary gets some of its territory back on all sides. And so the goal of the Little Entente has failed, and the Little Entente is sort of, you know, bleeding and dead in the eyes of most. But in the minds of Hungarians, there is still a Little Entente out there called the specter of the Little Entente. They fear that the little rumps of these states are going to get together again and try to push Hungary back into its interwar borders. The paranoia is palpable. And so you can see, this is Miklós Horthy, who says, "We Hungarians live with an open gate to the Balkans, so to speak, surrounded by peoples whose hatred is focused against us. That hatred finds open expression even today. The reason is mainly that these peoples do not gladly go without Hungary's valuable territories, which were given to them at Paris. In the alliance and cooperation of the Romanians, Croats, and Slovaks," see, they already see the Little Entente reforming, "we see forming around us another Little Entente, which does not even try to conceal its hostile intentions." And so there's an incredible amount of paranoia on the part of the Hungarians, and you can see the Hungarians got some of the territory. This is sort of interwar Hungary. They got territory from southern Slovakia, from Romania, and from northern Yugoslavia back, but they're really insecure about being able to keep it, and they're really worried about the new states of fascist Croatia, Romania, and Slovakia getting together to form a new Little Entente. The funny thing is that in some respects there was an attempt to reconstitute the Little Entente on the part of right-wingers within this region. So in June of 1942, for example, the following could be heard over the airwaves from the so-called Greater Romanian radio station. "The new Europe is coming together. Whether it is called the Little Entente or something else is not of the least importance. In any case, it destroys all those who seek to realize their imperialist dreams in Central Europe." So they had taken what had basically been, you know, conceptualized as a liberal alliance, and they had turned it into a right-wing alliance with precisely the same goals. It's not surprising that the Hungarians had plans of their own. And so in order to sap the power of this new Little Entente, the most extreme right branch of the Hungarian right, so right that it goes off lemming-like into an abyss, under a man by the name of Ferenc Szálasi, conceptualized something called the United Lands of Hungária. And Szalasi was so crazy that Hungarians, the Hungarian right-wingers didn't even trust him. And he was followed around from one end of the country to the other by the secret police, who kept tabs on him. And so one of the secret police who was watching him described his vision for a united lands of Hungaria thusly. Szalasi imagines Hungary's role in the new Europe as the member of a confederation with the five bordering states. With that, the country borders will disappear, as will the nationality problem. And in his diary, which is otherwise largely incomprehensible, but there's a passage or two that makes sense, Szalasi wrote that we must work such that all the peoples inhabiting the Carpathian Danube region come to form a moral, spiritual, material reality built not on historic rights, which is really interesting, throwing away historic rights, which was the one thing that the Hungarians came to the World War I peace conference with. And he's saying, no, it's not about that, because such do not exist. Very radical talk, but on the moral, spiritual, material vivacity of the peoples who make their home there, because that is all that matters. So as part of his plan, Szalasi felt Hungarians should form close bonds of cooperation with Germans, Italians, but also Ruthenians, Poles, Romanians, Serbs, Greeks, and Bulgarians. So he had this idea. There had been two ideologies that have sort of ruled the day during the interwar period, and maybe even the 19th century. There was nationalism, and there was internationalism. And both of them have proved themselves, you know, not up to the task of preserving what he thought worthy of preservation. And so he came up with another idea, which was sort of a halfway point and not really also, between nationalism and internationalism. And he called it con-nationalism, con-nationalismus. And this con-nationalism was a concept whereby everyone was supposed to be really national, and in being really national, they would be really national together. Sort of like this plan between the Romanians and the Poles, but also a lot like Giuseppe Mazzini's concept of young Europe, where there would be a kind of division of labor. You be yourself with a vengeance, we'll get together with you and be ourselves with a vengeance, and won't we be powerful together when we are really ourselves with a vengeance. So other extreme right groups in Hungary, most notably a group called the Imrédiek, were thought that Szalasi had really gone off the deep end. And the reason why they didn't like him was because the plan, the federation, would grant cultural and territorial autonomy to the neighboring peoples. This was antithetical to a certain brand of the right. And the difference of opinion on this point was apparent already in the summer of 1940, when the Imrédiek said, Hungarism, or the Arrowcross ideology, is unthinkable because it aspires to dissolve the Hungarian, the German, the Slovak, the Ruthenian, and the Romanian into a unit. We absolutely agree that we should all live in one state, but we should be the ones to lead and govern it. So he doesn't like this national division of labor, and most of the right thinks this is just too crazy. But Szalasi's more inclusive vision nevertheless found sympathy with Romania's extreme right, and, you know, just a little background here, the number of times in, you know, 19th and 20th century history when Hungarians and Romanians find any kind of sympathy with each other, it doesn't happen very often. And so when you see the extreme right doing it, then it's heads up time. So Szalasi's vision was sympathized with by Romania's Iron Guard as foreign minister by the name of Mihai Sturza, who met with the Arrowcross Foreign Minister Baron Kemin in 1944, quote, to consider the possibility of a radical revolutionary solution to the centuries-old rivalry between the two nations, whose quarrels throughout their history had always hampered tragically their ability to resist the attacks of their common enemy, yesterday the Turks, today the Soviets. And so you can see that they're looking to the east, and that the federation is defensive in some respects, and that they need to overcome their differences in order to achieve these defensive goals. Interestingly, in Romania, so just as the right-wingers in Hungary say, Szalasi, crazy, so do the right-wingers in Romania say that Mihai Sturza and the Iron Guard have also gone too far. So those right-wing Hungarian-Romanian sympathies were used by Ion Antonescu, who was the Romanian leader during World War II, to delegitimate the extreme right, the Iron Guard. And in 1941, the extreme right in Romania is actually eliminated by the other extreme right in Romania. So in a two-volume propaganda publication of the presidency of the Council of Ministers of Romania from 1942, the Antonescu government drew out the Legionnaires' supposed ties to the Hungarian Arrow Cross movement. And so this was used, in essence, to delegitimate them because they were associating, quote-unquote, with the enemy. So there's another final figure who gets excited about federation, and this is an odd... So this is... To give you a sense of what the United Lands of Hungaria would have encompassed. He's very, Salas is very sort of, he flies by the seat of the pants when it comes to drawing boundaries. He was also very kind of, he was into the Nazi aesthetic with sharp angles, and so it doesn't really get any more precise than this. Three, that was sort of what it's supposed to look like. And you can see that it's small relative to the size of entire Europe, but it's really central, and it's meant to be. And he imagines a division of zones of Europe, and his whole scheme is really quite complicated or incomprehensible. So there's one more guy, Andrei Bojci Zhilinski. Now this guy, if you've ever been to Budapest, streets are named after him. He's sort of a darling. And part of the reason for that was that he was an anti-Nazi. And the communists thought he was great because he was against the Nazis. He spoke out against the Germans in Parliament during World War II, pretty gutsy guy. But this man was really a right-winger. And during the interwar period, he edited a right-wing nationalist journal. He was very big on getting rid of undesirable, in his mind, inhabitants of Hungary, particularly Jews. And he had a vision, nevertheless, for a new Europe and a Danube federation. And he wrote a book in 1941 called Our Place and Fate in Europe, in which he called for a sober compromise with the other Danube peoples and thorough cooperation with them on the basis of an equilibrium of real power to realize the ancient principle of our nation, state, and empire, its never-expiring purpose, and to fulfill our European mission. So this guy, too, who's more or less acting alone by this point, people boo him down in Parliament, and he does all sorts of unpopular things. But this is like another branch of the right that is conceptualizing an idea of European federation. And he's saying, look, yeah, if we want to get these territories back, the only way we can do it is within the context of a federation. We can't do it by conquest. We're not strong enough. And the neighboring states all hate us. And the first chance they get, they're going to take it back. If there's ever another state that can form a client out of them, we'll lose it again. The only way we can get it and keep it is if we form a federation. And it's interesting that when the European Union expanded to include Hungary and then later it expanded to include Romania, part of the Hungarian so-called new nation policy was the reunification of all Hungarians within a single state in the rubric of the European Union. And so a lot of these ideas of federation about the only way we can get our old borders back is if we federate are still present in politics today. The Romanian president also said something about how reunification with Moldova can only proceed in this way. We can only achieve perfect national reunification within the rubric of the European Union. So a lot of these ideas that come from the right are comfortable in this these new governments, and the government that conceptualized the new nation policy in Hungary was the socialist government. They can't even tell left from right anymore when it comes to schemes of European federation. And the national and the transnational have gotten very confused in some respects. And the Hungarian president, László Sólyom, said something to the effect of, well, now we have, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact quote. Now we have an instance in which, in a new dimension of political space, we are able to achieve our centuries-old destiny. So we just have to rethink what national reunification means, and within the European Union, it becomes perfectly possible. There's also a keychain that I found in Hungary in 2005 that somebody had printed that said, long live the EU, and EU stood for Union with Transylvania, which was one of the territories that they lost. And so this slippage between federation and greater nationalism is quite common. So just to sum up, what we know about unification schemes are that they come from the East and the West, that both East Central Europeans had thought a lot about unification and about federation schemes within their own region. They didn't just come from the East and the West, but they came from the left and the right, and that it's oftentimes very difficult to tell when a federation scheme is left and when it's right, sometimes because it's the same person who looks like a liberal during the interwar period and then looks a lot like a fascist during the war, who is espousing some of these ideas. So Antonescu, for example, the leader, the Marshal Conducător of Romania, was one of these people that during the interwar period, you know, his best friend was France, and he even spoke French with Hitler, and he fought with the Allies in World War I, and then he becomes the leader of World War II Romania, and a lot of his ideas are consistent throughout this time period, as are those of many others in the region. So they come from East and West, they come from right and left, and also the rhetoric around them is about the preservation of peace. One has to take this with a grain of salt during World War II, obviously, but the rhetoric is that we can only get over our age-old tensions with each other if we federate, and that none of us is ever going to get exactly what we want out of any new European order, and so we may as well reconceptualize what it means to get what we want. And a lot of that came in the context of spinning European federation schemes. So another thing we know about these federation schemes is that they are as much national as they are supranational. That people oftentimes think of joining federation not by giving up who they are as a nation, but by strengthening who they are as a nation. As a matter of fact, most of these themes, these schemes come about and are national at their core. And they're about solving some of the same sets of regional interstate tensions and problems, minority rights, state sovereignty, and independence. So I want to give a little anecdote by way of closing, and that's on some of the legacies of this kind of thinking. I've hinted at it for the case of Hungary and Romania. After the war, variations on this Konnationalismus, this Konnationalism theme, continued to be in vogue. So if you consider Ferdinand Gyurcsánszky, who was the Slovak guy that I mentioned, who was the Hitler lookalike, but a little bit fatter, after the war, he sort of continued to exist. He went to Buenos Aires for a while, then he ended up in Munich, and he ended up writing for a journal called Nation Europa. And this journal advocated pan-European nationalist division of labor, much like the Young Europe had, and much like Konnationalismus had posited earlier. And he was writing together with Germans who shared these views, who saw European unification taking place as a union between strengthened nationalisms within the continental context. Okay, let's look at something from the complete opposite extreme. The notion of core Europe posited by Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida recently, and this was in a piece that they wrote to talk about how in the lead up to the Iraq war that Europe was going to be the new big foil for American power. So that's the subtext here, so 2003. And they said, Europe has to throw its weight on the scales to counterbalance the hegemonic unilateralism of the United States. And they wrote, and in the construction of this new European identity, the old Europe, namely France and Germany, would lead the way. Now what's interesting, if you look farther down in the text, is that even this notion is national at its core. Habermas and Derrida, in their Core Europe piece, when they suggest that in Europe, quote, the population must, so to speak, build up their national identities and add to them a European dimension. This is not about getting rid of national identities. It's about building them up. And you can only have an effective union if people are sufficiently national, not if they are deficient in the national category or if they give up their nationalisms. So it's also, interestingly, about solving and overcoming interstate and regional problems. If you consider the context in which the core Europe thesis of Habermas and Derrida is being posited, it's a product of national tensions as well. For the two men's act of coming together to make a positive political statement about Europe's trajectory makes sense only in the context of the neighborhood problem of German-French historical rapprochement. Yet in their essay, the resolution of that interstate problem is cast as the ultimate manifestation of European goals and values. And this is what so many of these federation schemes are about, where they're about solving regional tensions, very particular boundary disputes, minority troubles, but the language goes big universal and starts to talk about the new European order or the new Europe. And so it is within the context of this universal language that some of these particular issues get worked out. I don't want to poo-poo Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida, but it's interesting that some of the language of earlier right-wing notions of federation find their way into their conception. And it's not even the case that these are necessarily right-wing understandings, because as I said, right and left get very fuzzy when you're talking about ideas of federation. So the European Union shares many of the characteristics with earlier projects in terms of the problems it hoped to address and solve, but it was different, it is different in one thing, that it has its origins in Western Europe only. So it was born there. Nevertheless, it has its roots and its predecessors in both halves of Europe, and thus it should be possible to speak of a common history of European unification, one fraught with dangers as much as with benign precedents. Thanks. Questions? So good to see you again.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about what your working definition of nationalism is, because I just don't know when you're saying right wing. You know, I mean, to me, right wing nationalism is so anti-international, so anti-supranational. So I was having a little trouble trying to figure out how fascist nationalism, right wing nationalism, could accommodate any kind of transnational structure at that.
Well, this is precisely the interesting bit, and the problem is that these people are, I mean, that's why they're considered crazy by other right-wingers who are more sort of in the traditional sense nationalist. And basically, I think one of the things that this project does is that it fuzzes up what we, you know, this term nationalism and what we must mean by it, particularly to the extent that it causes us to rethink the notion of nationalism as being about the achievement of sort of basic stuff like national homogenization, national unification, and, well, I guess homogenization, yeah, some of that gets kept in the form of, you know, let's get rid of the Jews during World War II, but the national unification part is kept completely. And it's precisely because they want to achieve national unification that they turn to federation. And so it's not necessarily inconsistent with earlier notions of nationalism, because nationalism of the 19th century, this young Europe movement, is all about national consolidation and unification within a particular territorial complex. And so are these ideas. But they recognize that in the post-World War I order, that there are limits to what the state can do, especially small states. And I think even big states reach this realization that they're never going to achieve national unification and consolidation within a set of boundaries. And if they really want to achieve that, they have to alter their perception of what that means. And so therefore, they're willing to say that they're rethinking what political space is. and you know, cleverly and crazily at the same time, conceptualizing possibilities for national unification in things that don't look like nations. And this is what I think gets, this is why nobody talks about national unification, you know, these federation schemes from the right. I think partly for political reasons. It's nice to have a kind of clean history of these federative schemes. But also because they're so hard to get, it's so hard to get your mind around them. And the extreme right in these places have similar problems. They don't like these people. They don't trust them. And they see them as operating counter to the quote-unquote real national goals, which are, I mean, the one thing that they throw out the window, which is interesting, is homogenization. They don't insist on that. And I would, you know, like, I'm at the beginning of this project, so one of the things I'd like to look more closely into is how it is they come to the conclusion that it's okay to give that up.
And I actually want to push you to go ahead and make that intervention about right-wing nationalism in the 30s and 40s, because you do, I mean, fuzz is a great word, but, you know, it really does transform your notion about how nationalism is being, any tradition that starts with Mazzini and ends with fascists.
yeah, and it's sort of an odd trajectory.
Yeah, no, but it's a really interesting one, and I think you can, rather than feel like you have to explain that, you could use that as a, you know, way to rethink the way, in really in the kind of stilted ways, and in really kind of homogenous ways, we've thought about right-wing fascism and right-wing nationalism here. So.
No, it's an excellent point, and I think you're right that part of it, I mean, I'm still in doing the work of conceptualizing how to talk about it, mm-hmm. but you're right, if I could pin down that language, that would be something.
Yeah, and I think language is a big part of the problem.
Yeah.
Because you only have these limited notions, I mean, you use a word like nationalism, that's you know.
Right. Yeah. No. That's absolutely right. Even the term federation is fraught.
Yeah.
So yeah. Definitely. Definitely. Thank you.
Yeah. To what extent are they looking at the Soviet Union in that period of the 40s, not just as something that they need to have a defensive union against, but also I'm thinking in terms of these models for economic unification and the diversification then of resources and just being economically competitive, because it seemed like what they're talking about really is very similar to what the Soviets were attempting to do in terms of having different republics that were, you know, kind of in charge of different, you know, industries or that had different specializations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially in terms of the division of labor idea. And that's what I found so interesting, you know, because I actually got interested in this when we were discussing your book last time, is this, that one of the things you suggest is that neither of the national versus economic division of labor sides really wins. I was also curious, and we actually have a blog where we talk about what we're discussing, and I actually asked this question on our little blog, you know, was anybody looking at the Soviets? Did anybody pay any attention to what was going on? I haven't found any evidence that they're doing so, but my grad student was working on Poland, has found a couple of tantalizing tidbits about like communists in Ukraine and some of the aspirations that Poles had to reconstitute their, you know, old Poland together with Ukraine in part. And so there might be some stuff there, but I haven't seen it like farther south, which is not particularly surprising, except, you know, I guess the place I would look foremost would be one case that I left out of this is Bulgaria and the notion of a Balkan federation. And it's just because I don't know how to deal with it yet. The people who conceptualize the notion of a Balkan federation and who push it most strongly after World War II are this weird group that, I mean, it's another one of these, where's right, where's left, what's going on? They're kind of corporatist during the interwar period, and in the foreign relations of the United States, the State Department calls them fascists. But these people join the United Front, and then they come to power after World War II, as part of the socialist coalition. So they move perfectly between these. And Georgi Dimitrov is all big on their ideas for a Balkan federation. And so this is something I'd like to look into. And of course, Dimitrov knows a lot about what's going on in the Soviet Union. And so I guess I would look there first to see if they're borrowing models from the Soviet Union. And I wouldn't be as surprised to find it. But I still don't know how right-wing these people are. I don't think they know how right-wing they are, but that's part of the interesting bit too. The other place I'd look is Romania, because they know kind of firsthand. And there are also, you know, the Slovak ambassador to Romania, when he's, you never read the Romanians saying this, but the Slovaks say it, you know, they're comfortably ensconced. And they say, oh, by the way, when the Soviets came back into Bessarabia, a lot of the Romanians are seeing how they deal with nationalities and are thinking this is a great idea, that we don't do it half as well in Romania. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that model lapped over that way through Bessarabia, although I have yet to look, but it's an excellent question. I'll definitely hunt it down. Yeah?
I had a question about the definition of right-wing and mm-hmm. Isn't it that there's something about the content of the nationalist idea that is right-wing, or is it that it's an idea that's attached to a person who later turns out to be a fascist, and hence it's called right-wing because it's attached to a person then later called right-wing? And in particular, in terms of linking the origin, say, of this core Europe or other ideas to right-wing schemes, is the link to an idea whose content has some kind of right-wingness to it, or mm-hmm. is it that this is an idea that was linked to a previous idea which was linked to a person that had a right-wing? So I guess I just mean in terms of what would be left-wing nationalism, is that also just people on the left, or is there something in terms of the content of the nationalism that is right or left? Uh-huh. I wasn't quite sure what.
Yeah, well, and this again, I mean, you're right on the sort of crux of why it's so hard to talk about these things, because, you know, in 1830, like, right-wing doesn't mean anything, because nationalism doesn't really even mean anything in 1830. Not yet. And so, I mean, talking about right-wing nationalism for young Europe is way anachronistic, in my view. The reason I included it is because I wanted to talk about how some of these ideas that were, I see this first half of the 19th century as kind of a big boiling pot, and a bunch of bubbles come up and then they pop during the 20th century. And this is one of those that I think pops in a big way, but one of them that hasn't been tracked very closely, like how it's coming up and then, you know, what's in it and then what happens when, that's a bad metaphor. But I think what's the problem is when you get these figures, the way I've been using it is as follows. So once somebody is a member of a right-wing party, and right-wing by the standards of World War II, which is pretty far right, so there are a bunch of nationalist parties in these places, then I count the federation scheme as coming from the right. And so I've been attaching it to people who are themselves attached to parties. But this, again, is at, I think you're right, is at one remove. And one of the things I'd like to get at a little better is, I mean, as I mentioned before, a lot of these people, like, you have to take core samples of them. And if you do, you know, they look a lot like liberal Democrats in the interwar period. I mean, Djurchansky got a scholarship to study international law at The Hague. Antonescu got a League of Nations fellowship from the Carnegie Endowment. A lot of these people were doing lots of, you know, international cosmo-looking stuff during the interwar period, and then during the war, I mean, and the funny thing is that you can't even really see them being inconsistent. And that's what's interesting about these trajectories. I would almost, you know, a part of the way you could write this history is as a kind of collective biography of a generation that doesn't really change that much in its views, but so much of the the politics, the geopolitics, I would call it, around them opens up possibilities, closes down others. And so, I mean, you get really weird stuff. Like President, the Hungarian Prime Minister in 1941, Paul Teleki, he commits suicide in 1941. And the reason he does it is because, well, he wants to see a big Hungary again. But the reason he commits suicide is because Hungary is about to invade Yugoslavia. And he thinks this is a really bad idea because the most important thing that Hungary needs to do is A, go buy the book, do it legal, not by gift, and B, that it should never antagonize the South Slavs because that's, you know, you'll lose it again. He was convinced that this was a very bad idea. And so his suicide note, I mean, this man is ending an entire career where he's focused on geopolitics. He considers himself a liberal democrat throughout the interwar period, and he's called one during the interwar period. He's an anti-Semite who favors the establishment, the creation of a numerus clausus, and he oversees all of the implementation of anti-Jewish legislation. He loses no love for the neighbors, but he recognizes that rapprochement with the neighbors is geopolitically necessary. And he's actually in the vanguard of the school of geopolitics. He's an innovator in geopolitics, and he writes for journals called Geopolitics and Geohistory, and all of this kind of stuff. And so these people like Teleki, are experiencing all kinds of checks on the goals that they have. And they develop visions of, you know, what can be done realistically within geopolitical terms. And I think that's where a lot of this comes from, is kind of, a lot of our goals are good, but we can't achieve them all. And so what are the terms in which we can achieve some of them, or we can imagine that we have achieved them? And so he's no different in other regards from some of these other characters who are, you know, look very much liberal Democrats during the interwar period. It's funny that the wartime dictator of Romania, Ion Antonescu, he had this little scene where there was a British historian who wrote very sympathetic stuff about Romania during the interwar period. And the Romanian state had been giving him a stipend to continue writing very sympathetic stuff about Romania. And during the war, they said, well, should we pull out the stipend, you know, because he's technically a spy for the British, and, you know, we're on the other side. And Antonescu said, no, give him his stipend. I don't care if he's a Democrat, you know. I too am a Democrat when given the chance. But right now, these are not democratic times. We can't afford to be Democrats now. And so you can see them trying to, you know, I don't want to cast them in a sympathetic light because most of them are jerks. But but you can see them recognizing the geopolitical realities, or what they perceive as the geopolitical realities around them, and trying to negotiate to achieve a particular set of goals within those given geopolitical realities. And that's why right wing is kind of a meaningless term, as you suggest, except in that kind of core sample sense. You can, you know, during World War II, certifiable right winger. You know, he leads a country that's killing 200,000 Jews. He's Hitler's favorite ally. He's committed a million troops to the Axis war effort. You know, that there isn't a big question mark next to the right wing when it comes to 1942. But he's also the guy who, in 1943 and 44, tries to get Romania out of the war and to jump them over to the side of the Allies. Go figure. Yeah?
Sorry, I missed the early part of your talk. It's the history department reception.
I can smell the cheese from here.
So I apologize if I will ask you questions which you probably answered in your introduction. Just tell me that. The first congratulations on your extraordinary research you did on the Hungarian and Romanian sources. This has been mostly unknown to me. Nadio, this is really excellent. But I wonder whether the label about which the discussion is running, you know, right wing, is really adequate or exhausting for this period of the Second World War, because the war, after all, divided Europe into two blocks, mm-hmm. unless you emphasize the neutrality of Switzerland or Sweden. And so there were right-wing people who landed in the other, you know, if you insist on the label. I just, among the Poles who thinking about the Federation, I hardly find anyone who wasn't right wing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, and Pilsudski.
Therefore, this is. So since I mentioned the other side, the allies, I wonder. And let's start with Hungary. There are two names who happened to be, if you like, mentioned the first, István Bibó, about his book about the misery, la misère, the petits états de hôtelés. I know only the first French original. Where would you place him? He survived, I believe, in Hungary during the period, but he was definitely a liberal, but he must have been in touch. He couldn't be isolated from those who you call right-wing. But there is another person who systematically actually worked since the First World War on the Federation idea, a new relationship between Hungary and the Slav neighbors, and Romanians, namely Oskar Jassy. His papers must be at your university, right?
There are some things that,
because he survived the war in the United States. Mm-hmm. So he had this idea about Danubia during the war, and I guess since these ideas were broadcast by the BBC, particularly the Polish and Czechoslovak Polish idea of federation or the Balkan federation, there must have been some reaction in the Axis countries like Hungary and Romania in the press or in private correspondence you have seen and notes.
Yeah, I mean, this is something.
I wonder how you integrate this with the parallel ideas which were going on. And besides, I haven't mentioned actually the neutral institution which came first, I think, with very revolutionary ideas of restructuring the whole Eastern Europe because of the failure in 1938-39. Namely, the British Foreign Office, by setting up the Foreign Research and Press Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, all of these things are things that we've started tracking, but one of the things that we haven't found, and I mentioned the places where we did find them, and this, you know, a grad student of mine are working on these liberal or left-wing federation schemes as well, because we want to see how much they're influencing each other and where these points of contact are, and there are lots of them. Oskar Jassy is one, Mihai Károly, after World War I as well, has federation schemes. A guy by the name of Vámbéry Rustem also has schemes, and he's a left-winger. I mean, some people call him a pro-Soviet. And what's interesting is the trajectory of these people, and some of them remain pro-Soviet, and some of them become part of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, for example, like some of the people that I've been talking about. People like Stephen Kertész, who's he's right-wing but liberal in his conception of how states should be run, also has federation ideas for federation, but he joins the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations after World War II. The only trouble is there are only a couple of places where we've seen like direct lines of influence between, let's say, the heavy right and some of these left-wing liberal democratic notions of federation, because there are tons of them, literally, after World War I in particular. And so Jassy is an important one, but he's the tip of the proverbial iceberg, especially for Hungary. There's something called the Central and Eastern European Planning Board that comes into existence. There are two, it's the same journal, but it resurrects itself twice. It's called the New Europe. And it's published during World War I in Great Britain and during World War II in New York, where they spin off federation schemes like there's no tomorrow, and in some respects there isn't for federation schemes. And so there's lots of foment around these themes, particularly after these big times of conflict. And lots of it is coming from variations on the left. So our goal now is to figure out whether these people were in contact with each other, whether some of them from the extreme right camp slipped into the left camp or vice versa. And we only have a couple of anecdotal moments where we can see them referring to each other, like that they recognize that they're out there and that they're tracking each other's plans. The closest we've come so far is being able to say that, these ideas are in the air. And everybody, like knows about them in some respect. And so it's interesting that, you know, certain branches of the right should decide to pick up on them, or what I want to really find out is if they are so inherent to a certain form of right-wing thinking or nationalist thinking that they don't even need to look to the left to find them. And that's one of the things I'd like to sort out. Like, is Giuseppe Mazzini a good place to start, or would you start with the Austro-Marxists, for example? So there's a lot of work left to be done, and I think you're absolutely right. And what we're doing now is we're making a big database of every federation scheme that came about that we can put our paws on, and there are lots of them during the interwar period in World War II, and trying to see where the connections are, personal, ideological, and we're just going into the archives again this summer to look at some personal papers, which we hadn't dealt with before except published material. So I hope to be able to report on that next time.
We have time for one more question.
So you had a question, yeah. One
common feature of all the schemes that you've described is that they are initiated by countries or by individuals coming from countries that are not colonial powers. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering whether there's anything you can draw from this analogy, and rather than making parallels with the European Union, now whether you could draw some analogies and comparisons in opposition with actual, you know, colonial powers, various projects.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I mean, what is striking about these the right-wingers who come closest to conceptualizing a true federation is that they are not close enough to being imperialist. They are too much confederations of equal partners, which is what makes them unattractive to quote-unquote real nationalists who would rather see a situation in which, okay, Hungary gets all of its old borders back, and it lords over the Carpathian Basin and assimilates all of the non-Hungarians, or, you know, pushes them to silence. I mean, that would be more like the imperialistic model. And this was the one pursued by, you know, like mainstream nationalists who thought that, you know, this kind of domination in the form of expanded boundaries or re-expanded boundaries was desirable. And so what's interesting about these people is that they really are coming up with a very different idea of statehood that is not based on the imperial model, and that doesn't have this, you know, like, what do you call that? Like the lord nation, or the, you know, the
master nation.
Yeah, the master nation that's supposed to, you know, sort of oversee it all. And the whole point of these projects is that, as I mentioned, division of labor, which is, you know, which is interesting from the standpoint, because the imperial relationship was never one of division of labor, or it's never, you know, historically understood as one of division of labor, regardless of whether it actually operated that way. Maybe in the Habsburg, who knows? But maybe it's not a coincidence, actually, that these notions, you know, come to fruition in the context of the former Habsburg lands, because they're used to thinking about division of labor. It's not a bad, worth exploring. But this whole idea of division of labor, which is inherent also to the Giuseppe Mazzini Young Europe notion, is why I start with him. Because he's really the first one who imagines a Europe in which every nation plays a discrete role, which is not the kind of relationship that Britain has to India, or that you know, the colonial powers of Western Europe have with their African or other colonies. It's very different. It's oftentimes a lot about exploitation, or, you know, about stretching the long arm of empire to get raw materials, resources, etc. And so what's interesting about these people is that they're crazy by imperialist standards. They're really not operating according to these tenets. And I think it's worth emphasizing that they're really thinking on a completely different plane than what was common at the time, even by German standards, because the Germans were, you know, like, they were imperialist in their way, you know, like, they meant for the Neue Europäische Ordnung to be German dominated. And even if they didn't say that to their allies openly, they certainly said it amongst themselves, and they meant it, and they showed it in 100 different ways that they were going to be the, you know, the master race of the new Europe.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay, so in case anyone missed the memo, it is the case that we are now going to have Krikas in the year reception, so I invite everyone to stay for some light refreshment and beverage, and after we'll get started with that for a little bit, and then I'll briefly hand out and acknowledge our recipients of this year's recipients of our certificates in Russian and East European Studies, and also our master's students who are finishing up the program. So thanks again to our speaker, and I'll have a little bit more to say in about 15, 20 minutes or so, but in the meantime, I'm stalling here as the party items are actually magically appearing on the table behind us. Oh, there we go. Okay, so now I can just say, dig in, everybody, enjoy yourselves, and thank you very much for making this a great year.